Good evening and welcome to First Thursday Community Conversation. With Barbara Jean Johnson, I'm Jay Anderson. Now, each month we choose a topic for discussion, invite guests into the studio, and invite you to join in the conversation. On March 22nd, the day after the U.S. House of Representatives passed health care reform legislation, House Majority Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina received racist facts at his office. Nooses on gallows, racial slurs, vicious language. 5 years ago, the Red Lake Band of Chippewa finished building a $2 million detention center for troubled youth. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was supposed to request the more than $1 million per year needed to run the center, but it never did. Racism, individual racism, institutional racism, and racism in Cook County. Deconstructing racism in the community and the culture. That's tonight's First Thursday Community Conversation. Now, have you experienced racism at work and in the community? Have you caught yourself making racist comments? How do you react when someone tells a racist joke? Joining us in the studio to discuss racism in the community and the culture are three people who have participated in the Undoing Racism workshops, and they continue to stay involved with the issue. In the studio from Grand Marais are Bob Carter and B. Sorensen, and from Grand Portage, John Morin, who is a core trainer with the Undoing Racism workshops. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for taking the time to be with us this evening.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's begin by establishing a few basic definitions before we get into specific examples and possible ways to deal with them. First of all, a general definition of racism, and anybody can pick up on this and carry through.
Well, in the workshop process, we use what we call a working definition. The workshop process is called Undoing Racism. So it's really important to understand how something was done. And so we use a definition that really is not the People's Institute definition. It's a definition that was used by the National Education Association back in the early middle 70s. The definition that we use is we say racism is race prejudice plus power equals racism. And one thing that it differentiates our definition from any other definition is that we define each of the words in that definition for clarity to really understand what we're talking about.
Well, let's define those a little bit for us, if you will.
Well, I think racial prejudice is probably what a lot of people equate just off the top of their head to racism. Those are beliefs that are held basically without investigation, with very little knowledge, or based on information, incorrect information that was given to us over a long period of time. So that a lot of comments that people make, even as you mentioned, Jay, racist jokes are really a form of racial prejudice. But if you combine that with the fact that a certain segment of the society, certain part of the culture has the power that other segments do not. You put those two together, and that's racism.
And that power is prevalent. It's part of the structure and a part of the political milieu of this whole country. A power that is there not because it's warranted, but because it's a part of this racial prejudice put into that kind of a form.
So it's with us, sort of almost subconsciously?
Yes.
Well, we were talking about two different kinds, or a number of different kinds, of racism. So there's individual and institutional. Let's sort of differentiate between those two and maybe how they fit together.
Well, they're all interconnected, the individual, the institutional, and we call it cultural racism. Mm-hmm. They're all interconnected. They work together. One does not work alone. It's like they work in tandem. Individual racism is just, as we talked about, how we really believe that racism almost has become a norm in American society. And so you were right about many times people are unconscious of many of these things. They become almost like... For an example, that's part of cultural racism, we call it linguistic racism, mm-hmm. How words are formed in the English language. And so in a workshop process, will throw out a phrase, the only good Indian is, and, you know, we got a group of 30 to 40 people, and I'd say probably majority of those people, young and old, can end that, mm-hmm. which is what?
A dead Indian.
Dead Indian.
A dead Indian, and it doesn't mean, you know, they believe that, but what it is, what we talk about is it's so much in our consciousness, it's been passed on from generation to generation, that it almost becomes normal in the English language to use these without really understanding the historical root behind it. And so that's really what we're talking about when you were right about some people are very unconscious and are unaware of words that have been created, that what we say talk about some people in a negative way, and there are other words formed that talk about people in a more positive way. And so that's the dynamic of that, and that comes from a culture, what we say a dominant culture here in the United States that just permeates all of institutions and systems in this country, and then sends out certain messages, some negative, some positive, about certain folks based on your racial classification, and we absorb them psychologically in our mind, in our being, and we don't even know we're absorbing these. They're coming at us every day on a daily basis, and we then keep them inside, and I think, as Bob, we were talking about earlier, they come out at any time in our life without even realizing they're there. And we'll see somebody on the street and we'll react according to a stereotype, mm-hmm. or those types of things that are put out by these systems.
Just to give you an example, again, talking about individual racism, but how we acquire information that's incorrect. And this is a personal example. When I was a kid, I lived in a community where there were no people of color that lived in that community. None. And it was a suburb of St. Paul. It wasn't written down anywhere that they couldn't live there, that American Indians or blacks or Hispanics, but there were none. You could come into work, but you better be on the 5 o'clock bus going out. And I can remember as a kid walking home, and I found this, what I thought was a pretty cool cap. Somebody had lost their cap. So I put it on, and I'm walking home, and I think I'm pretty cool. And my dad, I love my dad, he's gone now, but where'd you get that? Where'd you find that, or where'd you get that cap? I said, I just found it on the way home. Well, he said, take that off. He said, you don't know where that's been. He said, he didn't say black guy. He
no, you didn't.
The N-word, could have had that. Well, now as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old kid, I didn't know any people of color. I didn't know anything about, but that lodged in my mind for a long time that, well, there must be something wrong with them then. And I sure don't want to have anything or be associated in any way, because that's obviously they're not as good as we are. Mm-hmm. And that's how subtle it can be.
John, you mentioned the historical roots of racism when you were talking. I'm wondering if you can go into that a little bit. What are the historical roots of racism in our country?
Well, we have to go back to the history of the term race. If we mm-hmm. want to understand racism, which we put an ism on the end of a word and it becomes an ideology. And so if we really want to understand racism, we have to go back and understand the beginnings of the concept of race. And so we have to go back into the late 17th century when this concept was created. Eventually, physical anthropologists would create the terms Caucasian, Mongoloid, Australoid, Negroid, and these are the beginnings and the roots of the concept of race. And they were, and of course, they were defined for certain segments of, at least what we would call the human family. And now their task was to classify the human family. And of course, whenever we learned this in school, in an anthropology class, they're always listed in a hierarchical way, so that Caucasian is on top, then the others, the Mongoloid, Australian, and Negroid is on the bottom. It already sets up a biased dynamic of how people are classified. And of course, this will then be the basis for institutions and systems that would come about in the United States based on that classification. And so that's kind of a little bit about the history of how racism started. And of course, you know, you go back to why did these two men do that? Why were they doing that? And so historically, we have to understand what was going on at the time. Colonization, European nations were going and colonizing island systems and other countries of color. There were people of color, and there was also something that we call the slave trade going on. So, we really believe historically, when we look at all the information, that there was an intentional reason behind these classifying certain people, and that eventually it would be a classification that would put certain folks on top and other folks on the bottom, so that with those different various anthropology terms, you can also put a color scheme to it, so that Caucasians will become white people, Mongoloids will become Asian people, Australoids will become other indigenous people from Australia, but also from the North and South American continent, and then the Negroids will become the people of Africa, or black people, colored, all these other terms that have come about in history will be given to these people. And so that's kind of the beginnings of what we call the roots of racism, and how it first came about and some of the reasons why.
If I could just piggyback on that, one of the things that came out of the Undoing Racism workshop that I went to what was exactly what John was going through. And we've heard those words all our lives, and some of us far more than others. I'm not looking directly at you, Jay, but those of us who are about our age in school.
Yeah, right.
And what was so interesting to me was, first of all, that these classifications were basically based on size of skulls that they found archaeologically. And supposedly, the Caucasian, which again became white, first of all of them were kind of designated from an area where they came from. So what they said was that, okay, white people came from the Caucasian, not Caucasian mountains, but
Caucasus.
Thank you, Caucasus Mountains. Mongoloid from Mongolia. Australoid, as John said, from Australia and other parts of North and South America. The Negroid was the only one that was not classified by area they came from. It was classified by color. Mm-hmm. They also determined that the white, or the Caucasoid, skull was a little larger, therefore the brain must have been bigger, therefore they were smarter people. And this was taken as fact then. Now, and since then, we've learned that all of us came from originally Africa. But so, and you can see how that kind of a thing then being taught, being learned, becomes not only individual and cultural, but becomes institutional through the school system.
Well, I think it was interesting. John was talking about when this began, so many centuries ago, and at that point there wasn't any real archaeological explorations being done, and so the assumption was that the human race came essentially from that Caucasus region, which meant, you know, of course they had to be the best. But at any rate, so it becomes. It's a part of the language, and of course, language is the way people express their culture.
I have an illustration from my childhood of this hierarchy that John and Bob have been talking about. When I was 11 years old, fifth grade, I lived in a Cherokee village in Oklahoma, and my mother was there to be a school teacher in high school. I was in fifth grade. One of the things that the teachers were told, that if they knowingly taught a black student along with the native students and the few white students that were there, that they would be fined or penalized or whatever, but there was a law against doing that. So there you have that hierarchy where somebody has put the black at the bottom. I would like to just comment a little bit more on the individual racism and the birth of my awareness of racism. That year that I was there was a delightful year, but in that whole year in fifth grade, I did not learn one thing about Native culture or history, not one thing. It was a shock to me years later when I heard about the Trail of Tears, which was how the Cherokee people came to be in Oklahoma to begin with. But that was not taught. It was not even considered important. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I didn't realize was that this boarding home that was there, where young children were taken away from their parents and brought and kept in town in the boarding home so they could go to school was not a very normal kind of a thing, was not the kind of a thing we should do because we were being good to the Native people. So that was just the beginning. When I finally had enough information to reflect back on that childhood experience.
Let's step away and get a larger view here, because I want to talk about the prevalence of racism in this country. If, in fact, racism is a part of our culture and society comes from the culture, then where are we in this country with racism?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that there's the tendency to think that we've come a long way. And I suppose in one regard we have. But it has not been without a lot of pain for people of color, as white people are the dominant class, or the, as a lot of the Native people call it, the settler class, has imposed our will on other people, trying to make them like us. And yet, in fact, shortly after the election of President Obama, I heard a young black woman talking on an NPR or on public TV about the fact that we live in a post-racial society. And that really struck me because, again, one of the great blessings of having gone through the workshop is suddenly you become aware of so many things that you just did not ever notice before. And recently I saw a quote by Julian Bond, who gave an address to McAllister College, and he basically said that there were 250 years of slavery, 100 years of oppression, and 50 years of half-hearted, lip service. And he said they're asked to believe that there was no permanent damage or that racism doesn't exist. And he makes a statement that it absolutely does and that, in fact, trumps everything. So, yeah, it does continue. And I think it's a lot subtler than it used to be. It's a lot more covert than it used to be. But I think it's clearly there. And I think examples happen all the time. And I remember one of the things, it was very shortly after the workshop. And I remember hearing a Native person say, you don't know what it's like to walk into a store and have somebody either physically or at least with their eyes follow you, as you are shopping through the store. And I happened to be in the Twin Cities and I was in a convenience store waiting to pay for my gas. And I watched the way the clerk, who was white, treat the customer who was in front of me, who was black, compared to the next person who was white, and it was dramatic. It was absolutely dramatic, and I had never, ever seen that before. So I think it continues.
Well, what we try to get people to understand and be aware of in the workshop process is how institutions perpetuate a lot of the stereotypes. And first of all, the Institute, how it got first started was by two African-American men who were community organizers. And in their organizing efforts, one of the things that really stood out to them after so many years of organizing is that, and especially after all, they went to a lot of community organizing training, very good training, they said, but one of the things that they were continually running into in their community organizing efforts was these institutes never talked about race, history, or culture. So history is really important to understand the history of institutions, how they were created and who they were created for. For instance, I'll talk about the educational institution. Again, as Bea said when she was growing up a few years ago, there was never taught in the history classes about African-American culture, Native culture, Asian culture, any of the other cultures of color, that there was basically one culture. And today we call that in the United States white culture, just permeates all these institutions. And so it's a very biased way of teaching our young people about the human family, excluding some. And so we're continually trying to make inroads and to change the curriculum. And I guess I'm happy to say that next year there was a book called The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, who recently passed away. But they decided that they should create a book that's a little bit easier to read for high school students, middle school students. And they have come out with a book called A Young People's History of the United States. And because I get involved in the school, sometimes go and talk in the classes when asked to talk about history, our history of Native people. I also then participate in the curriculum, social studies curriculum committee. And so I gave the book for the teachers to read. They've read it, and I think they've decided that they're going to incorporate that into the curriculum next year as 7th grade or 8th grade or 10th grade students are taking the American history class, that now they will have another reference book to read along with the mainstream curriculum. That so what we really are trying to say is that racism, because of the biasness of the concept of race, once we understand the history of race, it just permeates all institutions, the educational, the government, social service, just by their foundation and how they created, how they were created and how they've been functioning for the benefit of some folks. And those are people that have been classified as white people in the United States, and how they are there not to really be accessible to other people of color who are classified as American Indians, Asian Americans, African Americans, Hispanics, or Latino. And so we say that, bar none, all of the institutions in this country and come from that basic creation of, and so they're biased, and so that's how it's perpetuated.
And the people who are in charge of these institutions are white throughout the county and throughout the nation.
And what I just heard, in a way, the two of you say is the dominant culture gets to call the shots.
Sure.
That's still happening.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. One thing, for people who aren't familiar with the book you mentioned, John, how will that People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, how will that help combat racism in terms of incorporating it into the educational system? What is it about that book?
Well, what I've learned about history, and I've kind of was in my early college years, began to really study history, so I've made that a part of my whole adult life. If you had a good memory, which I had a good memory when I was in school, and that got me through many classes, especially history, because all you had to do is memorize times, dates, places, people, and you take a test and get an A. So that was easy for me to memorize. And so that's how history is taught in this country. But what I've learned over the years is there's a certain essence of how history should be taught, and history should be taught from the perspective of people's struggle in the United States. And that's what Howard Zinn finally did. He wrote a book that really talks about the people's struggle in creating the United States, and gives credit to a lot of folks that helped build this country. And so I think the book, The Young People's History of the United States, comes from that perspective that really gives you a more people's understanding of history, and that's really important.
It's not just this general, and this year did this. It's
yeah. Okay. And what that will do is help young students see the contributions of more than just people who just came from Europe and became Americans. And I think that will help them begin to understand and get them through to question a lot of the stereotypes that have been passed down through various generations, and really understand that's one of the problems of people in their relationships and how they relate to each other across racial and cultural lines. So I think the book is really important. And will be beginning to help.
And whether or not that's comfortable for the dominant culture.
Well, and almost all of this is uncomfortable for the dominant class because, yeah. I mean, the system, and when you talk about institutional racism, the system is predicated on keeping the dominant class dominant. And even if you, I read an article by a woman, she was talking about the sexism, and she said, even if men acknowledge that women have not had the same opportunities, they'll acknowledge that, but what they won't acknowledge is that they have to give up some of theirs. And it's right. It's the same thing. One small example, and again, this came out of the workshop. I met a Native American fellow who I think, if I'm not mistaken, lives in Canada, comes down here to do some stuff with the band up at Grand Portage. And he had bought a recent model, I can't say it's brand new, recent model conversion van. And when he, on more than one occasion, as he would drive across the border and go through customs, he was asked by the U.S. Customs, is this your van? Now, I've driven across that border, I can't tell you how many times, and I have never been asked, mm-hmm. is this your car?
Yeah.
So that's just another example of how it can...
Well, let's piggyback on that a little bit, because we started to get into it. Tell me who benefits from continuing a culture of racism, and are there social benefits, economic benefits, psychological benefits? Is it that it must be a good deal?
Wait, I'm gonna interject and just hold that thought for a minute, sure. Jay, because we do have a caller on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a couple of points. You can kind of keep them in mind, take them one by one. First of all, it's my impression, and I think it's based in the literature, that a lot of these racist people, the ones who really are the far out, which we're seeing now on TV, are basically pretty low in their own self-esteem, and they kind of gravitate toward others of like mind to kind of form a mass which makes them feel free to express their ideas, but I think their basic problem is that they're very fearful people that don't have the self-confidence to meet what they consider negative impacts on their life directly and with confidence. And the second thing that I'd like discussed is, what about descriptive adjectives? It seems to me we need to get beyond the point where we still refer to four black teenagers break into a convenience store and smash the place up. Or on the other end of the line, a Native American astronaut who happens to be a Chickasaw from the Chickasaw Nation is commander of the space shuttle. But to my way of thinking, that teenagers breaking into a convenience store has nothing to do with their being black, and probably the fact that the commander of the space shuttle is of the Chickasaw Nation has very little to do with him becoming a astronaut. And I'd like that. It seems to me we need to get rid of these adjectives. You know, just four teenagers broke into the convenience store. The commander of the space shuttle is named such and such. I'd like to take those answers off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, let's take the last one first. What about descriptive adjectives? He's right. You don't have four white teenagers breaking into a store.
I think what happens is a couple of things. Number one, and again, I think it's a classic example of institutionalized racism, in this case, the media, who very somewhat subtly, at least, continue the racist stereotypes in that, of course, you know, here's another example of black people of color behaving badly. And isn't that always the way? There's also a reverse to that. And that's, in my mind, at least as interesting, is when they interpret somebody, a person of color, succeeding, a Tiger Woods. That's maybe a bad example, but...
But a Tiger Woods... A couple of months ago, it wasn't so bad.
Tiger Woods, who is a... You know, they talk about all the things he does on behalf of African-American people or black people, and he's a credit to his race. Have you ever heard anybody say about a white person they're a credit to their race? But that's kind of a reversed form of, again, stereotyping through language.
Mm-hmm. Just an example, when we talk about a dominant culture and how that kind of smothers or other cultures, as the person that called in referred to the Chickasaw astronaut. His name was John Harrington. And John Harrington understood who he was as a Chickasaw, became an astronaut, but also kept some of his traditional ways. So John Harrington, in his space flight on the shuttle, wanted to take some tobacco pouch. But apparently, because of NASA's rules and regulations about smoke-free, blah, 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 it's not that he was going to smoke it.
No.
He tried to explain, it's not something I'm going to smoke. I'm carrying it in me because it's we're talking about the spirit of the tobacco when we put it in a pouch and carry it with us. But he wasn't allowed to do that because the dominant culture didn't even want to begin to understand him as a Chickasaw, but only viewed him as just another astronaut when something like that was pretty dear to him, and that he would have felt a lot more comfortable in space with his traditional tobacco. And so it's just another example of a dominant culture and how that has no respect or even takes in consideration of other people's culture.
Would you know whether or not NASA objected to somebody wearing a crucifix?
No, they wouldn't.
Probably not.
What about let's address the caller's first question about the low esteem thing. Now, this was out on my list of things to ask you, so let's go to it. Is fear a part of racism?
Oh, absolutely, I think. It's part of individual racism. It's the fear of the other, of the fear of what we don't understand or what we don't know. And, you know, when John was talking earlier about the definition of racism and racial prejudice being improper information that we've been given, acting upon incorrect beliefs, we do that because we have that fear of the unknown, fear of something that we don't understand. And it's, you know, I think for people who are out and out blatantly racist, it's pretty easy to see. Where it gets tougher to see is in those people who are not in your face necessarily with it, but who is still practicing it. Mm-hmm.
What about the economic aspects? Oh, go ahead, Bea.
Well, that was just what I was going to lead into. I just read a very interesting article called What White People Fear. And it was by a man named Robert Jensen, who is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And he said, white people fear living without the privilege that comes with whiteness. They fear losing what, in quotes, he says, our way of life. There is a measurable gap as far as wealth and well-being is concerned between white people and people of color in income, home ownership, graduation rates, access to health care, infant mortality, and so on. And so I think there's very much an economic aspect to what people fear.
Tonight's topic is Deconstructing Racism in the Community and the Culture. Our guests are Bob Carter, Bea Sorensen, and John Morin. Now, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned the situation with the Red Lake Juvenile Detention Center and the lack of funding. Also, recently, Senator Al Franken highlighted the lack of performance at 4 northern Minnesota reservation schools and indicated he didn't trust the government's data on that because that's not what he'd been told. So now, specifically, is Indian education the victim of institutional racism, government racism? How does the government stand on this?
Well, yes, it is. It's Indian education is definitely a product of institutional racism. Here in the United States, going back historically to the assimilation attempts by the United States government, you know, we can go back to the very first industrial school, Carlisle Institution, which would be the model of all boarding school systems in the country, that would take our people there at very young ages and not allow them to speak the language, the only language they knew, punish them for that, punish them for following their traditional ways. We call them educational prisons. These were not educational institutions. To break up the culture, break up the family, and, you know, I'm a second generation. I never went to a boarding school, but my mother did. My father went to a mission school, a Catholic mission school, and was raised there and assimilated. But my mother went to Pipestone. It was a federal Indian boarding school, and She used to tell me stories about her experience, very negative, and she used to make me cry, and I could never understand why she would tell me these terrible stories of her experience. But she was never bitter about that experience. And so the There's been racism from the beginning as far as in relationship to Native people and our whole education. And so there have been various reports beginning in 1928 with the Merriam Report. As near as the 1969 Indian Education Report called Indian Education a National Tragedy, that brought out a lot of statistics as to why Native people weren't getting proper education. So my mother had some real negative experiences in the boarding school, and then there were certain pieces of legislation like the Indian Reorganization Act, the Johnson-O'Malley Act in 1934. Because of what the Merriam Report uncovered of the basic atrocities that were taking place in these boarding school systems. So, and many people don't understand that history, and so they don't understand why Congress appropriates federal money for Indian education purposes. I really don't like that word where they say we're treated special. Well, wait a minute. The educational institutions have treated those people called whites special from the beginning, and now that they're appropriating federal money to supposedly incorporate that to develop curriculum that talks about who we are as a people, our culture. That somehow that's special when we've been when that kind of curriculum has never been developed or talked about.
In speaking of schools, this is kind of a rough segue, but I do want to get to this because last month some students, again talking about how early and soon that this can take place, and as a result possibly of schooling, but some students in the St. Cloud school system admitted to racist anti-Somali postings on their Facebook pages. One was a student expelled from St. Cloud Tech, and he said he was brought up believing that this was a white Christian nation. Let's talk a little bit about religion and racism.
Well, I think that there's an important distinction to draw there, and I think that organized religion, or religion, if you will, that word has kind of taken a bum rap over the years. But for lack of a better definition, I think you can go back historically and go to very, very recent times and see that religion has really gone out of its way in an effort that I suppose at a time or to some people could seem praiseworthy, but again, trying to make other cultures be like us. And so you've got, John talked about mission schools and also the boarding schools, and it's repeated over and over about how the missionaries, if you will, or church leaders went into Native communities, tried to Christianize them. The slaves, when the black Americans were slaves, trying to again Christianize them, all an attempt again to make the other more like us.
We've got a question that just came in from a caller that I'm going to read here. Isn't racism rooted in ignorance about people different from ourself? I grew up here and we were not taught anything in the schools about Native culture. Unless you were an athlete, you were picked on if you were Native American. Anybody want to speak to that experience of this caller? Is racism rooted in ignorance?
Yeah. and fear. But then it takes on something that's far more, to my mind, insidious than that. And that is, and we were talking about it earlier, when you've got a dominant, when it gets institutionalized then, when that fear and when that ignorance gets institutionalized and then built into systems so that perpetuates itself for the benefit of one segment, then it's even more than ignorance or fear. Then it's, I'm not too sure.
Okay, so here's a way to maybe break down this person's question. So on that individual level, it's maybe rooted in the ignorance and in the fear. And then on the institutional level in this person's question, the fact that they weren't taught anything about Native culture, that's how it's embedded in the system.
Absolutely. And if you look at one of the things that they do, and that's really enlightening in the workshop, is to do an analysis of the systems that that are in place in our culture and how, in fact, they perpetuate institutionalized racism. And they talk about the neighborhoods and, I mean, everything, schools, insurance, business, the whole thing. And it's, again, what's so hard to fight or, yeah, battle or combat it is because in many, many cases, it's so covert that it isn't the person that's in your face screaming racial epithets. It's defending a system, acting as a gatekeeper for a system that will keep that system in place and keep one element of the society or culture up and another one. It treats it like a zero-based system, that if, in fact, I give up some of what I have, or if you get more, I'm going to have to give up something. When in truth, if we all get more, we all gain. That makes sense.
Go ahead, John.
Well, yes, there's ignorance, but there's another thing is anger. So I think people of color are very angry that the mainstream curriculum still doesn't teach our culture and our history. And so that we hope that once people from the dominant culture, which we call white culture, and those people that would benefit would be those people who have been classified as white people. And of course, we always say you're more than that. So that we're angry. I've been angry my whole adult life, you know, and even as a because of what I learned or what I didn't learn in history classes or any of the other curriculum I was forced to learn to graduate from high school. We hope that white folks get a little angry at a lot of the things that they're not learning. They're not being told of the truth in history. And that's what it's all about, that we come together across racial and cultural lines, and really what we hope happens is people begin to organize so that not only it's not just us, the Native people, going down to the school board and saying, how come you don't teach Indian history here, that we hopefully we form allies with many of the people in the white community, and they join us. Because what we really say when to understand racism is they have the power. They have the power to change institutions. And really what we're talking about is not doing away with an educational institution and starting over, or doing away with a social service institution and starting over. They're doing some good things. What has to be done is they have to be transformed and be more inclusive of other cultures. And teach young people respect for all other cultures, and I really believe that's really an important part of undoing racism.
Well, what can the white community do then? I mean, you've just said that it seems to be the responsibility of the Native community to go to the white community to remind them. If you can set that dialogue up, what's it going to take in this society under these circumstances today for that dominant culture to meet you halfway? What do they have to do?
I think that's one of the benefits that comes from these Undoing Racism workshops, which we've had approximately every other year. People learn in what ways they have been acting as gatekeepers to keep things the way they are, to keep other people out, so to speak. They also learn that they have power to help effect change. And there have been a number of people who have gone through the workshops, and I do believe it has made a difference. The people have found ways in which they can, in small ways, bring about some of the change, and in bigger ways.
Mm-hmm. How do I recognize racism? What would I be looking for? What's going to sort of pull the curtain away from my eyes, or anybody's eyes, for that matter? I mean, is it that obvious, or is it only going to crop up sideways?
You know, I think the way you see it is by trying to open your eyes to what John said, to trying to become an ally. I read or heard sometime that the main thing that you have to do with a woman when she talks about abuse is you must believe her, and you must take your lead from her. And I think the same thing has to happen as far as racism goes. We have to be open. We have to be responsive to to the lead that is given to us by the people who are most affected by it. I remember at the workshop that I went to, we were having lunch, and I was sitting next to a core trainer who was white from Duluth, and I made some statement, typical, I'm probably sure, of somebody who just had their eyes partially opened, and now I'm going to go out and speak on behalf of the Native community here. And she looked at me and she said, Native people have voices. You don't need to speak for them, but you need to work to create an environment where their voices are heard. And I can't do that unless I listen to John and to others as to how best to do that.
That seems to be a pretty prevalent attitude where the dominant culture keeps telling the other cultures what it is they are and where they what they should do and
what they need.
And they don't ever listen. I mean, how do we get that beyond that, I guess, is what I'm after. Or can you? How tough a struggle is it going to be?
Well, it's going to be a tough struggle because it's been here for so long, you know. But what the workshop process does at the end is gives a little bit of a session on organizing and how we can organize as communities, as across racial and in cultural lines. We talk about accountability, that institutions and systems have to be held accountable. As Bob said, these institutions have spoke for us, and that as B talked about gatekeepers, we define those people as gatekeepers who many of them working within institutions and systems, and take a social service program that we often ask the question, who are they accountable to? Are they accountable to the people who give them, sign their paycheck? Are they accountable to a board of directors that set bias and racist policies, and they just carry them out without question? And so it's really important for people to, as much as they might love the institution, that they must also be willing to question many times policies, the structure of the institution, and how they're maybe sometimes giving service to people of color, or not giving service to people of color, or giving service in a way that is really not very respectful to those people. And so that's what we're talking about, organizing together and coming in and questioning. You know, we're not taught to question. You know, our educational systems, I keep hammering on the educational system, but we're talking about ignorance. And one of the most important things to be an effective organizer to undo racism is to continue to keep educating ourselves so we are not ignorant anymore, and we can't blame some of our actions, our behaviors, and things we say on ignorance, that we've got to have an open mind to learn new things. And really, we believe that's what the workshop process does. It gives people new language on how to talk about racism, so they aren't fearful of it. But we also say that, you know, if you're going to try and change these institutions, there could be consequences, because they're going to want to keep maintaining the way they've been doing business from day one. And so we say we've got to organize with integrity and intelligence. We've got to be strategic. We just can't go in there and change these systems overnight. It's going to take maybe another couple more generations here in the United States, but somebody's got to lay the foundation and begin the work to begin to change and transform institutions.
You mentioned two words, listening and respect.
Yes.
So that might be a place to start?
Yes, I believe so.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And being more intentional in including on our boards, in our various structures, social structures that we have, so that we have the opportunity to listen.
Mm-hmm. In doing that, though, John, we're inserting a kind of system in our society for doing things. And I've heard it referred to by people in the Indian community as white tape, as opposed to red tape. And I mean, in doing that, by in trying to be inclusive, are we just trying to include you into our system? Or are we really trying to break down the barriers in our system to you know, include you in that way. How do you view that?
Well, they have tried to bring us into the system and change us to become part of the system or take on the identity of the system. That's the way things have been going, and what it's going to take is, see, one of the things that I really liked here, I think it was been a few years ago, you bring in many people of color and come into this community and work in many of the businesses, the stores. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a few years ago, one of the things that I thought was really nice or really neat was they put on a dinner for many of the people that come from South America, come from Africa, and I think invite people in to talk about their culture. And I think those are beginnings. Those are things that have to take place so that we begin to gain respect for other people, so that when people from Somalia come over here into the St. Cloud area, that they aren't greeted and relationships developed based on stereotypes.
The good news, John, is that there is, in fact, a movement right now. There's a group of people who are interested in making just exactly those connections with international workers mm-hmm. that come here, mm-hmm. talking about having dinners and get-togethers and this sort of thing. And so we're going to watch that, follow it.
We had a comment/question from a caller. Shouldn't we be dealing with the youth, educating them on racism? I think we've talked about this a bit already, but anybody want to respond to that? How do we educate young people about racism?
Oh, yeah, and I think John has talked about that as far as the school system to work to make the curriculum more unbiased. To look at the contributions and the importance of all the cultures and that have made a difference in this country, and in other ways too. I think that we've got to make on a variety of different levels. We need to make our voices heard. I have some friends who are Dakota, who and again I've always looked at Fort Snelling. And just talking from the educational standpoint, Fort Snelling is this symbol of American greatness and the westward expansion and so forth. And at least the westward expansion, that's true. Whereas Native peoples, particularly Dakota, view this as oppression. This is a symbol of oppression, that they were driven from their homes. And in fact, part of Fort Snelling was an internment camp for 160 some people shortly after the Dakota-U.S. war in 1862. And so here we've got a national park that was in fact a prison camp for people, and that doesn't seem to bother us. And in fact, on the Fort Snelling website, not Minnesota Historical Society, but the Fort Snelling website, there is no mention of, in fact, those internment. Those are the kinds of things from an educational standpoint that I think have to change. And it's the people of the dominant culture who need to, I think, pressure that to happen in any way they can.
Let's make a kind of a full circle before we have to leave and come back, using that as an example. If, in fact, that kind of educational system is established and we begin to educate our young people about the total history as opposed to just the specifics that we choose, does that not then pose a threat to the dominant culture? How do we get by that?
Go to the workshop. No, not trying to. It doesn't present a threat because, and I don't remember the name of the woman who wrote the book that I read, but her point was racism diminishes us all. It diminishes the people that we put down through the system that is racist, and it diminishes those of us who are perpetuating the system as well. To get people to see that, a lot of people have to just keep talking about it, I think. I really do. I really do. I think we need to call people on it when. And it's not always comfortable to do. That you mentioned right at the outset, Jay. Have you ever told a racist, or have you ever laughed at a racist joke? Have you ever made a racist comment? To call ourselves and others on that when it happens.
Well, that will have to do it for tonight. Deconstructing Racism in the Community and the Culture. Our guests have been B. Sorensen, John Morin, and Bob Carter. With Barbara Jean Johnson, I am Jay Anderson.